coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome back to Worth Doing Badly on Lutheran Radio UK, this weekly survey of the Bible lessons for each Sunday of the church year, with me, Jamie Krieger, and David Weber. The Bible lessons for this Sunday, the 11th Sunday after Pentecost, are from Isaiah 56, verse 1 and then 6 through 8, the Psalm is 67, the epistle lesson is selected verses from Romans 11, and the gospel lesson, which we always begin with, is from Matthew 15, verses 21 through 28. What's in the gospel lesson for this Sunday, David?
I am treading on what I think could be a territory that's easily misunderstood. But what we have are these passages that are trying to define faith. And unlike our dogmatics books, the scriptures don't actually give abstract definitions. It talks about what faith is in the context of Jesus's teaching, and then how faith is actually exercised as a practice. And so last week, the gospel lesson talked about the disciples' little faith. Now this week, it talks about this woman's great faith. And as I said, it doesn't give us a definition. It just tells us that there is this thing called faith. It is a great advantage. It's crucial to understanding what it means to be in relationship to Jesus. And so the gospel lesson will focus on Jesus saying of this woman that her faith was great. After he says that, it's very interesting. He says, Jesus said to her, let it be as you desire. So faith is associated, almost synonymous with her desire to have her daughter healed. So we'll contrast this woman's great faith with the disciples' little faith, that her great faith was that she expected Jesus to fulfill her great desire for her daughter's healing. The disciples' little faith, they did not expect Jesus to actually save them, to actually make good on his promises, and so they lived in fear. So the greatness of her faith, as it becomes evident in our discussion, it takes place over a discussion of food scraps. And once again, food becomes the context of faith. So again, the Bible doesn't give us a lot of abstract definitions. It makes associations. So her great faith is in the context of talking about food scraps, suggesting that, as Jesus said, let it be to your desire. The desire of faith is akin to the desire of hunger. And when we're hungry, it's kind of a pleasurable experience because we know that we will be satisfied by food. When we have a desire for things that nothing in this world can satisfy, that only Jesus can satisfy, that desire is not a sign of despair, because the woman actually believes that Jesus can satisfy her desire, and she would not have this desire if somehow it couldn't be satisfied. So, rather than just jumping to the miracle and all that, Jesus enters his teaching mode as an excellent teacher. He wants her not only to enjoy the experience of the healing of her daughter, he wants her to understand what has taken place in his rescuing her from her situation. So he tells the woman that healing her daughter would be akin to giving away children's food. Now this cuts to the quick, because a woman is definitely interested in her daughter's welfare. She would never ever think of taking food from her daughter, and yet Jesus in a sense is telling her that if he heals her daughter, he is taking away food from the children. She answers back by expanding the inquiry in a sense saying, yes, there are children, and you dare not take away if you're a parent, you dare not take away the children's food, but there are also dogs in this world. And dogs also get hungry. And dogs also are fed. So she says back to Jesus, if I live in a world in which God has created both children and dogs and both have their ways of getting fed, consider me a dog. And let's talk about feeding me in terms of a dog. And I think dogs are marvelous. I've been doing some reading about how miraculous their capacity for being domesticated was. What a remarkable history that was. And so she is appealing on a level that, how is it that these remarkable animals have their appetites filled? It can't be from stealing the children's food. There must be another way. And the woman's faith is that she knows God as creator. And she knows that God gives both the gift of hunger and food. They are all part of the goodness of God. That God does not give us needs that he does not intend to fulfill. So in meeting Jesus, she now, the God who she trusts as creator, she now is convinced that the creator has come to earth to save his beloved creation. And she's arguing there's no better place to start in this salvation than to save her daughter. She has this desire. She believes that the Savior is there to fulfill the desires of our hearts and that he will, in fact heal her. So she, in essence, she said, if the healing has begun, why not fulfill her desire to have her daughters healed? You're here to heal. And so let's begin right here with my daughter. She didn't know how or when the healing would happen, but she knew God was a God who makes promises and keeps promises. She didn't know a lot, but by virtue of her faith, she knew that somehow her desire would be fulfilled sometime, or the universe is a fraud, and she would be stuck in despair of desire without fulfilled hope. So here is an example of what we can, when we see this woman characterizing great faith, we could spend a whole lot of time looking at the details of what this great faith was. And if, for me, I'm just saying it was her great desire, expecting that that desire is going to be met by Jesus, and recognizing that if Jesus does not meet that desire for salvation, then she lives in despair. Now we go to Psalm 67. And as I said earlier, Jesus wasn't just interested in healing her daughter. He wanted the woman to understand the nature of the salvation. And so he taught her as well as healed her daughter. And so the Psalm says, to know on the earth your way, your rescue. The psalmist is praising the idea that somehow we can know how God is working in our lives. It's not enough to just have God do these things. God wants us to be a participant in understanding these things. And that is the knowledge of faith. That's the knowing that comes through, this faith. So the psalmist, enjoys God revealing to him his way of rescue. He wants to know how it's going to take place. So once faith reveals to us that the cosmos is in the process of being saved, when we see that the creator of the world has in fact come into the world to save it, then the psalmist says existence is changed. At that moment of understanding, when faith apprehends that God is saving his world, then that faith changes my next moment of existence. I no longer live in despair. I no longer live in a world in which my desires are finally denied rather than fulfilled. The psalmist is giving words essentially to the Canaanite woman, who knew that if God was not there to rescue her, then her existence was an existence of despair, and life essentially was a fraud, making promises that it did not fulfill. To say that we live by faith is, says the psalmist, to know on earth your way. The faith isn't just something that has its value when we die. It is a knowing on earth that changes our very existence, the way that God is functioning and rescuing us. And then what's interesting, what's added to this is that because it is not obvious that God is rescuing the universe, because not everyone sees it, we have to look for signs. And the psalmist says one of the most important signs of this knowing of faith, of this understanding, is that music is produced. The faithful will express the fact that their longing for rescue has been met by God, and that comes out in the music that is produced. So the psalm begins with instructions. The lead player on stringed instruments, a psalm, a song. So in other words, the disciples' little faith left them paralyzed with fear, while great faith in understanding that God is there to fulfill his promises leads to all sorts of things, one of the things being this expression of our new relationship with the world by virtue of what we know by faith, that produces art and music. When God does, in fact, fill the hungry and fulfills his desires, that leads to an authentic and spontaneous praise that eventually becomes in composition of art and music. Isaiah also is glorying in God's rescue. Now, if you read all through Isaiah, back and forth, he's wondering whether God, in fact, will keep his promise to rescue. But here he says, for my rescue is soon to come. Isaiah is assured at this point that he is in trouble. God is there to rescue him from his trouble, because that is his most profound desire. Isaiah knows for sure that he is in trouble. He knows by faith that rescue is coming. So the question Isaiah struggles with is the relevance of knowing by faith in a world of concrete experience. Most people think that living by faith or knowing by faith isn't real knowledge. It's more like superstition. Isaiah struggled with the idea of how do I say that I know by faith when I can't actually prove it in the concrete world? And here he says, I live by faith, which means I am not controlled by fear. And if I'm not controlled by fear, then he says, I will continue living to keep justice and to do righteousness, even though it doesn't look as if that's rational, even though it doesn't look like it's reasonable. I will live, Isaiah is essentially affirming, in the presence of what I know by faith, that God is my rescue, and consequently, being just and doing righteousness is, in fact, the rational thing to do, given what he knows by faith. It is trouble that is temporary, it's righteousness that is eternal. So when we're in trouble, we can make believe that the trouble is the most important thing. That was a little faith of the disciples. Jesus was right there with them, and yet they lived in fear that their trouble would overwhelm them, and so they lived in fear. The alternative is to say, no, trouble is temporary. Trouble is not finally going to be victorious, and therefore to live in the presence of the reality of faith is to live in the presence of justice and righteousness. So if rescue is real, then living by faith means living by what we expect to take place and not by what's taking place now. This is what I like about the praise in worship. It oftentimes seems so out of touch with reality. And yet, the reason why we praise in season and out of season is that we, by faith, know that our rescue is certain and coming. And if it proves that God's rescue is unreal, then of course worship is ridiculous. And of course worshipers are to be pitied. But if rescue is real, if it, in fact, by faith, we know it is actually coming, then worship is one of the ways that we can enjoy right now in the present this coming good. Now we get to the most remarkable passage, I think. in the remarkable assertion in Romans is Paul says, I am the apostle to the pagans. Now, we shouldn't try to ease up on the translation. The word pagan is not saying bad people. It's not even saying evil people. Paganism is a kind of religious belief about the universe. And it is a tragic universe in which you have more desires than can actually be fulfilled. Paganism can be very, very violent and evil, because that's what happens when people are disappointed in the world. And Paul then says, you want to know who I am? I am the apostle to the pagans. And I thought, what events had to transpire for Paul, who was an absolute purist, to now identify himself as God's called apostle to rescue the world from paganism? Now, we know that this apostolic rescue of paganism would begin with Paul, and it would continue for centuries of sacrifice and violence. You can go to various parts of the world and see where this struggle with paganism, where this rescue of paganism took place. And so to study Paul and his apostolic mission to paganism is a study of what it means to believe that God intends to rescue the world and how that rescue began with the incarnation. Again, I'm puzzled and am interested all the various things that had to have happened with Paul, culminating in his own conversion, where no longer is he going to enforce the purity of the Old Testament, but he is rather going to live among the impure and do his best to try to translate the truth of God incarnate into a way to show them that what they truly desire, as he said on Mars Hill in the Areopagus, when he says, what you really desire, you don't know it yet, is that you desire the God who brought to earth the resurrection. So Paul imagined, when we get to this passage, that Paul imagined that God's rescue could even use Israel's sad rejection of Jesus in order to expand the scope and sweep of his rescue. Even the greatest disappointment in Paul's life, he expected that disappointment to somehow work together for good in carrying out this rescue plan that Paul himself says that God had called him to. He fully expects that even Israel's rejection will somehow be part of a larger story of reconciliation and mercy. So in other words, Paul, if we were to ask him, how does your faith change the next moment of your life? He would say that rather than despair because of rejection, the rejection is real, I live in the hope that Christ's reconciliation through mercy will take place. I wonder how hard this was for Paul to affirm. I know when people have done me ill, I oftentimes remember it not fondly, not looking for reconciliation, but with resentment. How many times was Paul mercilessly ill-treated, physically injured, imprisoned because of this apostolic ministry? And yet without resentment, he continues to express his expectation that reconciliation will rescue those that he has every reason to be bitter about, that he would not accept this adversarial relationship as final. What by living by faith, expecting Jesus to keep his promises, he would then see that the future is that of reconciliation. And so to be stuck in the past with past grievances is to live in a dead relationship. This has been packed, Jamie, I think. If I was going to be preaching on what it means to believe that God will rescue us, I don't know which of these four passages would be the best to go. I am, as you could probably pick up, I'm deeply attracted to the idea that somehow the woman's great faith had to do with her desire for her daughter's healing being fulfilled, and that One of my favorite theologians, Augustine, thought very much that that's what faith was, is that we have these deep desires and God intends to fulfill all of the desires of our hearts.
Thank you, David, for once again helping us think through how these lessons work together. And thank you, dear listener, for tuning in. If you have any questions or comments, please do write to us at info@lutheranradio.co.uk. We will try and reply as best as we can, as soon as we can. Take our survey online. When you go to lutheranradio.co.uk, you will be prompted with an online survey. Please do fill that in if you can. And if you want to listen to previous podcasts of Worth Doing Badly, go again to lutheranradio.co.uk and find Worth Doing Badly in the schedule of programs. If you don't have it yet, download the Lutheran Radio UK app on your mobile phone or tablet. That's it for today. David and I will be back next week at this same time here. Join us again. David, goodbye.
Goodbye, Jamie.